This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
I'm a roadrunner, honey.
Driving around? Are you dying to get there? Despite the hype, cars kill thousands every year and we don't even pay attention. Shocking, not shocking, the car oil industrial complex buys political cover year after year, and media soaks in the advertising money. Nobody will tell you, except investigative journalist, filmmaker, and author David Obst. Hear it all as David talks about his new book, Saving Ourselves from Big Car. Cities from America to Asia are finding better ways to get around.
I love to drive.
A huge brown tide of killer algae last month off Australia asks a big question again. Are harmful algae blooms increasing in warming seas? What suddenly kills dolphins and stingrays and millions of fish at a time? Did you know toxic particles from coastal blooms can float right into city air? We get the latest from one of the global experts on algae blooms, Dr. Mark Wells from the University of Maine. I'm Alex. This is your in-depth dose on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
David Obst is an American journalist, publisher, filmmaker, and author. As a literary agent, Obst helped birth explosive works of investigative journalism, including All the President's Men and Seymour Hersh's expose of the My Lai Massacre. David's 1972 book, Ecotage, with Sam Love, triggered an ongoing debate in environmental activism. Now he's out with a new book called Saving Ourselves from Big Car. From California, David Obst, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you so much.
After a few decades of expose journalism, you are back with a new target. Did something in particular get you asking the big questions about Big Car?
Yes, they did. I was driving with my granddaughter from Santa Barbara, California, where I live, to Los Angeles, and we hit a horrific traffic jam. And I said to her, "I hate traffic." And she looked back at me and smiled and said, "Papa, you are the traffic."
And you're not just talking about car manufacturers like Ford or GM in the book. How do you define big car?
Big car is a conglomeration of the automobile industry, the oil industry, insurance industry, the asphalt industry, lobbyists, and others who combine to make automobiles and transportation as we know it now something that will make our species extinct very soon.
I would add a lot more to that complex, like plastics companies. The modern cars are mostly plastic. You've got a large complex of tech industry for increasingly computerized stuff and screens.
Absolutely. And that, those are included in the, you know, for example, a really good example of what you just said is the tech industries have provided tools for big cars through car manufacturers and insurance companies to, of course, now be able to trace you as you drive. And if you speed or you accidentally bump your car, your insurance premium is going to go up, whether it was reported or not, because the insurance company has that information.
And I just saw a television special saying that the new Apple software in cars is also taking that manufacturer information and selling it on for advertisers to send you more personalized ads. It's great, isn't it?
Oh, we're just so lucky to have them.
But on the serious, serious side, David Obst, tell us about the death toll from car use.
Well, it's unfathomable because your listeners are aware of two things. One is that they have, in America alone, about 45,000 people die each year from car crashes, right? But they don't call them crashes. It's the only business in the world that can slough off what their product does in killing these hundreds of thousands of people and call it an accident.
Yeah, it'd be hard for the tobacco companies to say, well, there were a lot of accidental deaths from our products. How many people did you say worldwide were killed by cars every year? I missed that.
Worldwide is close to a million. But here's the most salient fact. Let me just do a quick synopsis of how we got here and take about a minute. Is the biggest problem in urban America at the beginning of the 20th century was the horse. Into New York City, each day would parade 130,000 horses, each leaving over 20 pounds of manure and 12 gallons of urine in the city streets. And cities became impossible to live in. So we invent the car. First cars, and the most popular, believe it or not, were electric cars, which were really popular at the very beginning of the century. But with World War I, the precious metals needed for those cars went to the war effort, so that sector disappeared. They were replaced briefly by the external combustion engine, which was steam, which we used to power our locomotives and our steam ships. But the problem is not everybody could afford a chauffeur to warm the car up each day and get it running, and it was just inconvenient. So ultimately, the prevailing technology that won out was the internal combustion engine. The internal combustion engine runs on gasoline. But as your older readers will probably remember, gasoline doesn't burn cleanly in these engines, and so you'd have loud backfires and cars would be coughing and sputtering and stuff. So in 1925, three wonderful companies, Dow Chemical, General Motors, and Union Oil, formed a corporation called the Ethyl Corporation. They came up with an additive that, when added to gasoline, burned in the engine smoothly. Problem solved. Except that additive was lead. Lead is not good for human beings. In fact, it's poisonous to human beings. In fact, it kills them. What happens is lead is burned out of the cars, goes up into the atmosphere, but it's heavier than air. It floats back down. And people inhale it. When you inhale it, it goes into your bones and your teeth, eventually migrating up to your cerebral cortex, where it replaces the calcium in your brain, makes you crazy, and ultimately kills you. From 1926 to 1977, when finally lead is taken out of car gasoline, the World Health Organization says that over 70 million humans died. That's more than were killed in all of World War II, and not a single person was held responsible.
Wow. Well, on the lead topic, I checked, you know, your book contains 1,000 facts, and I looked up so many of them, and they all check out, except I found this one, what I think may be an error. I just want to cover that. And you write, the problem with electric vehicles is that they are all powered by lithium batteries. They must be replaced every few years and contain large amounts of lead. According to the World Health Organization, these batteries are responsible for more than 75% of all deaths caused by lead poisoning today, end quote. Well, I doubted that's true, because electric vehicles are not that numerous in many parts of the world, and there's lots of other sources of lead out there. So
I agree, but what you missed on that was that these batteries tend to burn out after 2-3 years. They then take those batteries to recycling plants in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in other undeveloped parts of the world, and they melt those batteries down to get the lead back so that they could put it into the next generation of batteries. And it's the refuse of that that's causing most of the deaths from people inhaling it.
the experts that I could find, and there's a new paper out on this, just published September 30th, 2025, after your book came out. The title is Environmental Lead Risk in the 21st Century, and they say it's due to ongoing coal usage, legacy contamination, and people, as you say, recycling batteries, but they're talking about lead-acid batteries, the kind used not in electric vehicles, but in older vehicles. Anyway, it's a tiny point, but I just wondered.
Just the last point that I'll, and I don't mean to be contentious on this, but we had a horrible fire out in Southern California, in the Pacific Palisades. There were more Teslas, because it's a very upscale community, that burnt and exploded. They are now finding extraordinary amounts of lead in the topsoil of that area and in the dumps in Calabasas where they're putting it. So lead's very pernicious. I mean, it just hangs around. It sneaks up in you. But the thing that's indisputable is that lead is a poison and that it kills people, and that we poured so much lead into our atmosphere during that 70 years that tens of millions of people died because of it. And this is not my saying this. This is the World Health Organization saying it. Duke University did a study in which they found that violent crime went up proportionate to the amount of lead in gasoline over a 50-year period. And then when lead was taken out of the gasoline, went back down to its former levels. That's not a coincidence.
Yeah, we know consuming lead can reduce intelligence, the IQ, and some suggested lead dinnerware helped the decline of the Roman Empire. It kind of makes you wonder. I mean, Americans were gassed with lead for 70 years until 1996. Maybe that's one reason for the rampant public stupidity that we can see these days.
Well, it could be part of it. And one of the points I make in the book is the reason for that is because journalists like yourself, scientists, research laboratories, and universities like Caltech and MIT were prohibited from having access to the data on what the effect of lead was on human beings for that entire 70-year period. And any time they were hearing about the efficacy of lead, they would trot out these extraordinarily well-paid scientists who said, there's nothing to see here. You're just talking about a lead herring.
Okay, now, all of this culture is deeply in our brains, and some of our listeners are hearing your voice right now over their car radio. Tell us about how car radios changed living and even the music industry.
Well, in the book, I go into three sections. The first is how and why the automobile became part of the world culture. And one of it was particularly through entertainment. In the old days, in the 1950s and well into the 1960s, if you wanted to have access to entertainment, it primarily was through sitting in your parents' living room, and they had control of the dial. So you would watch and listen to the TV shows and radio stations they wanted to listen to. Cars come along, and the car radio is put in. Kids suddenly now can become their own DJs. They can pick whichever songs they want, and they do. Big Car realized that this is a gold mine for them. Mustang sends out 1,000 free cars to radio DJs so that they'll push their product. And it works, because now you're your own DJ. You can listen to anything you want at any volume if you want. And it was a very liberating thing for kids, in particular, to be able to listen to the music however they wish.
I loved it that you found a list of women who made useful inventions for cars, never got paid for it, never got credit. Everyone thinks it was Henry Ford. Tell us about the parts of our cars that we have women, bright women, to thank for.
Well, my two favorite stories that I write about in Saving Ourselves from Big Car is one is an amazing woman named Bertha, whose husband is an inventor. He builds the first internal combustion take it out on the road because there's no such thing as a gas station or a service place. And it sits in his garage for almost a year. One morning, Bertha takes, she and her two kids, and they go on the first road trip in history. They drive to her mother's house. Along the way, various things start to go wrong with the car, and she solves them. So, for example, the brake pads don't work properly. She takes her kids' shoes, takes the leather off of them, puts them around the brakes, and invents the brake pad. Another woman is on a trolley at the beginning, about the 1930s, and she's noticing that every time it rains, the trolley driver has to eventually get out and wipe his windshield because he can't see where he's going. She invents the windshield wiper. Because she's a woman, she can't get a patent for it. She gets no stake in the invention of it, and she gets nothing. And there's numerous other stories like that. I mean, women didn't have very many rights, period, but they had virtually no economic rights.
And big cars are deadly for all of us, as we've said, but it can be racist, too. How were cars used to further impoverish and criminalize black people in America?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, let me break it into three parts. The first is Dwight Eisenhower, who was a famed Allied commander during World War II in Europe, sees the Autostrada and the Autobahn and says, we have to have that for America to be able to transport our troops more quickly around. And equally as important, to be able to evacuate our cities in case of a nuclear attack, which everyone thought was going to be coming. So he gets passed the National Highway Act of 1956, except he wraps it around national defense. So it's the National Defense and Highway Act. Just a fun aside, which I'll get back to my main point. Every bridge that you drive under today has the same height as it did then because that was the height necessary for a flatbed truck carrying a thermonuclear weapon behind it. It's what they needed to be able to pass through these bridges. Okay? So Eisenhower gets the largest public works project in American history legislated. It's paid for by gasoline taxes. And billions and billions of dollars are spent. Everything that's not nailed down in America is paved. Tens of thousands of miles of roads. They give the discretion of where these roads are going to go, even though the feds are paying for it, to local governments. Local governments pick the poorest constituencies that exist in their districts and use eminent domain to move them out. So communities are wiped out in periods of weeks where churches, schools, homes used to be. There are now highways, freeways, and thoroughfares. Secondly, the people who are left there, mostly of color, are now right next to all of these cars spewing exhaust, right next to their homes. So their health is severely damaged by it. Third, insurance companies would not give insurance to people of color unless they bought high-end products. If you wanted to buy a Mercedes or a Cadillac, they would give you insurance, but any other car, no. So what happened was all of these people bought these cars, and of course they couldn't keep up with the payments. So they got repossessed, and the new people would buy them, and new people would buy them. And these companies made a fortune off of exploiting that. The last thing was that when these roads are built, you have white flight out of cities, people moving into what became the suburbs. Okay, the people who are left in these cities are restricted from living in the suburbs by what they called red line laws, which was, it was illegal to sell a house to a person of color in certain places like Levittown and others, right? They also had sundowner laws in these communities, which all the way up to the 1960s, which said that any person of color who is caught on the streets in these communities would be immediately incarcerated. Most importantly is the downtown area in our major cities, because of the white flight and businesses moving out into the suburbs, into shopping malls and others like that, completely lose their tax base. So they no longer can afford to put in new drainage, rail lines, new mass transit. They're the poorest of the poor. And the legacy of this for people of color in this country has been, I would argue, as bad as Jim Crow racism in segregating them from the rest of our society for so long.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is David Obst, and we're talking about his new book, Big Car. So, Dave, introduce us to the big lobby machine that buys politicians to stop pollution control and action to reduce emissions.
The latest statistics are that close to 94% of all people who run for office are those candidates who spend the most money. Big Car gives, on an average, each election cycle 15 times as much money to politicians as environmental groups do. So who do you think they're going to listen to? The politician who's received the most money from Big Car last year is Chuck Schumer. The way it works is that if you're running for office, having a contribution of $15 or $20 from an environmentally aware person is nothing when you can get a donation of $150,000 to $200,000 from a lobbyist. And let me just speak briefly about the impact of lobbyists on our society. The departments that were supposed to be protecting us and our public health and our rights in transportation became very early a revolving door of mostly white men who worked there for a few years and then were offered stupendous salaries to become lobbyists. They would go in and talk to the new people who took their jobs and say, look, just play ball with us for the next couple of years and you can get a job like mine. And they did. And so nobody was protecting the consumer. I mean, we knew for 40 years, Al said, that seatbelts would save tens of thousands of lives, but it was never legislated into our having to do it. And the reason for that is that Big Car would have had to pay an extra $4.13 per seatbelt to put them in their cars, and they didn't want to incur that car. And the only reason we finally got them was because airbags were going to cost them more, so they, in a last desperate attempt, they put seatbelts in, hoping to forestall airbags, but it didn't work.
And we might think the American Automobile Association is looking out for all the drivers, but tell us about AAA's fight against pollution regulations and even against global climate action.
AAA has been one of the more egregious villains in this story, in that they have been a pawn of Big Car since their inception. But if you look at the name, the Automobile Association of America, I mean, they were founded to protect cars. Here's two good stories about how they protected cars. At the beginning of the wide usage of cars in the 1920s and early 1930s, cars were killing a tremendous number of people on the road. The reason for this is most people were just used to being able to walk on the streets whenever they wanted. When you suddenly had this massive amount of lead, metal coming at you and hitting you, you always lost. So people were beginning to get upset about this, and there were even some protests beginning to run. So Big Car comes up with an amazing invention, jaywalking. AAA, the Boy Scouts of America, and Big Car began to go around the country and have teams of young Boy Scouts and others patrolling the streets, running up to individuals who crossed the street, not in prescribed areas, grabbing them, giving them citations, blowing whistles, and street shaming them into not doing it anymore. society has opposed any legislation in Congress that stipulates that roads should be used for mass transit as opposed to expanding private public roadways. They also denied that climate change existed until very recently. So they're no friend of individuals, but they're very close friends with big cars.
You grew up in Los Angeles, and last time I went down the interstate with all its feeders, I counted 22 lanes in L.A. Interstate 10 in Houston gets up to 26 lanes if you count the frontage roads. In 2012, the U.S. Geological Survey estimated parking lots covered approximately 5.5% of all U.S. land, and it's only grown since then. And, you know, it changes the albedo of the United States. It adds to the heat island effect. That's why we're sweating it out in the cities, partly. Tell us about some alternatives to that.
Well, in saving ourselves from your car, I put at the end of the book a list of 10 communities who have become part of a mobility as a service movement to try and reduce the use of private individual cars. So cities like in Tempe, Arizona, in Portland, in Singapore, in Taipei, and many, many others, Copenhagen, they've come up with alternatives to using your big car. And I'm trying now to work with my local community here in Santa Barbara. And I would urge your listeners to do the same, to find alternatives. And the way to do that is find people who think like you do, who understand that if we keep using big cars, we're going to make our species extinct. Expanding roads doesn't do any good. Textbooks used by road engineers who make these decisions on what we should do with our tax dollars on roads are the same as were used in the 1950s. They haven't evolved at all. And you build more lanes, it does no good. Just more cars fill those lanes up, and everything again stops. What we have to do is come up with alternatives for people that show them that it's convenient, safer, and will save the environment. What we're doing in Santa Barbara is a program where you can get picked up at your house by a van. It takes you to a mobile hub. At that hub, you can catch an electric bus, and you know exactly what time it's coming because the technologies allow people to have total tracking of all of their mass transit vehicles. So the car picks you up at 8:30. You know you want to catch an 8:45 bus. It drops you at the mobile hub. You take your bus. You're where you want to be, or if not, there's bikes, scooters, and other forms of transportation that will take you to the nearby place you want to go. You come back to the hub, van picks you up, brings you back to the house. You've not had to park your car, you've not had to use any gasoline, and you've saved yourself hundreds of dollars each day by not using your car.
We're going to have to wrap this up, but I know you're always working on something. What else are you working on these days?
Oh, thanks, Evan. Well, I'm doing a project with all of the university college newspapers in America called Universities Speak. You can go to our site at universitiespeak.com. What it is that so that Duke University has some egregious thing that the Trump administration has done to them. They've cut off funding to their medical school. We interview a student from Duke and her father, whose medicine has been cut off and he's going to die. Duke puts it on their school website and their school newspaper sends it to us. And we then send it out to hundreds of other websites and school newspapers around the country. We have Yale, we have the Annenberg School at USC, we have all the University of Missouri, we have all of the major university college papers beginning to work with us. If any of your listeners live near a university, go in and see your college editor and tell them about University Speaks and get them to join us so that you're not not isolated and alone. You can share your stories of what's happening in your community, and we will get them out so that it's the last place where people will be able to read about it, because they can't read about it because major networks are not going to cover it. Local news stations are now owned by a select few group of people who are not going to talk about it. So the last burning ember of a free press are our college newspapers. So I urge your listeners to go to any college that's near them and tell them about this. It's free. We're not affiliated with any political party or anything else. We're just doing it to try and keep a free press alive.
I support that, and I also support nonprofit radio, and that's another voice that's still going because it's listener-supported. It doesn't get money from Ford Corporation
or any corporation.
Yeah. From California, we've been speaking with culture bender, filmmaker, activist David Obst. You can find links to his new book at ecoshock.org or check out www.stopbigcar.com. You can find out more there. Dave, thank you for keeping up the good fight.
Oh, well, thank you for spreading it. And if you ever come to Santa Barbara, please come in and let me take you to lunch.
I'll come on my electric bike. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Just before we get the inside scoop on killer algae blooms, let us stop to remember one of the great women of our times. Jane Goodall passed away last week at age 91. She was indeed good for all. Exploring and then living with African apes from chimpanzees to the great apes, Jane did more than teach us about other intelligent life here on Earth. With that mirror, she taught us about ourselves. She was kind and wise for decades as her documentaries thrilled kids and grown-ups. Here is a clip of Jane Goodall at a conference as played on Radio EcoShock in 2006.
What are my main reasons for hope? Somebody said, I don't know if it was you, Malcolm, somebody said that we weren't prepared to change the way we live, to live on less sustainably. I don't think that's true. Is it true? Don't you think we can change a little bit? Just shout yes. because they do. We can change. Maybe some of the older people can't, but won't. But it's really, you know, okay, it's my greatest reason for hope. But secondly, my next reason for hope is this human brain. And I think that we've sort of emerged to where we are, because when we get our backs to the wall, we're really very inventive and imaginative. And I think we escape from the sort of era of the last of the dinosaurs and the early mammals, when we were very insignificant. I mean, you know, we didn't have any sharp teeth, claws, we couldn't climb, we couldn't fly. And we used our brains to get by when there were all these giant saber-toothed tigers and things like that. And so we've got these amazing brains, we know what we can do with our brains. Now our backs are to the wall, we are beginning to come up with innovative solutions. And I think the wealthy here can play a really major role, because the wealthy can afford some of the new technologies that will help us to live in greater harmony with the planet. And eventually then these technologies will be affordable by more, and they'll be refined and honed and made cheaper and so forth. I haven't met a single problem where there wasn't a person, or usually a group of dedicated, passionate people who are prepared to give up almost everything, who work for no money, who risk their health, who risk their lives and sometimes lose their lives to try and put these problems right. And family planning is one of those problems which has taken people into far out places and sometimes put them in danger, because there is so much opposition, so much lack of understanding. So it is this feeling that I sense around the world of an awakening of people who are understanding our backs are getting very close to the wall. And our Roots and Shoots program, all the people who are out there working on problems like family planning, other environmental problems. These are the army of people who can help us to make this a better world so that we do not destroy the last beautiful places of the planet for our future children. Because we need Mother Earth, we need the beauty of some of the wild places, and we need the beauty of the trees and the birds for our proper spiritual or psychological growth. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk at such a wonderful conference to such great people.
That was Jane Goodall at a Bixby conference in May 2006. Jane, you showed us our better nature. In May 2025, brown foam took over the beaches near Adelaide, Australia. That toxic bloom of algae grew to thousands of square kilometers, leaving masses of dead creatures behind. You may think harmful algal blooms are increasing with global warming, but is that true? Scientists who specialize in these blooms have been working on this problem for over a dozen years. In 2015, experts gathered to workshop, and the summary paper was published, Harmful Algal Blooms and Climate Change, Learning from the Past and Present to Forecast the Future. Professor Mark L. Wells was the lead author then, and again in 2023 for an update on the science. Mark is Emeritus Professor of Oceanography at the School of Marine Sciences, University of Maine. He is the co-chair of the section of harmful algal blooms of the North Pacific Marine Science Organization. From Maine, Mark Wells, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, hello there, Alex.
Before we attempt the climate connections, let's get a few basics in place. We may think of plankton and algae in the same category, and hardly anyone understands why tall seaweed-like kelp is called algae and not a true plant. Mark, what is algae?
Well, algae, you've hit upon one of the basic, if you want, separations. We have what we call macroalgae. These are big pieces or big organisms that grow quite large. So you think about kelp, you think about seaweeds. These are macroalgae. There are also microalgae. They are different parts of the evolutionary chain, but essentially they're doing much the same thing. They photosynthesize and they grow, they build their biomass based on the use of photosynthesis and the nutrients that are in the water. Macroalgae may be attached to the bottom, but they don't have roots per se, so they're not like a tree or anything like that. When we talk about algae in general, we're covering both of those. If you want the plankton, which are the microalgae, and we're talking about macroalgae. So it sometimes can be confusing, but you need to try and identify which of these groups that people really are meaning to talk about.
And just to add to the confusion, a type of bacteria is generally called blue-green algae. Is it algae? And would that be included in your reports on harmful algal blooms?
That's a great comment. And yes, they are. They are bacteria, so they're a different part of the evolutionary scale. But they use sunlight to photosynthesize, and therefore we think of them as phytoplankton, even though they are bacteria. And when we talk about harmful algae, particularly harmful algae in freshwater environments, most of those are the cyanobacteria, or some people will refer to them as blue-green algae because of they have a different set of pigments than, say, marine phytoplankton or a lot of the other phytoplankton, I should say.
And there are thousands of different kinds of algae, but only a few are harmful. Why is that? And how does algae become toxic?
Okay, so first I think we should clarify, when people talk about harmful algal blooms, in different parts of the world, they actually refer to them as red tides. And this was actually in North America, much of the Western world, we used to talk about red tides as well, because certain types of algae, the pigments they have, make the water color turn a red color when they get in high enough biomass, when there's enough of them there. some of those red blooming organisms are what we consider harmful, and many are not. And so the idea of using red tides has sort of shifted now to harmful algal blooms. Now, when we talk about harmful algal blooms, you mentioned toxic. That's one of the categories of harmful algal blooms. The other ones are what we call high biomass blooms. In other words, where the phytoplankton grows to such an extent that when they die and sink to the bottom, the degradation of that biomass leads to oxygen deprivation, and basically you end up with large parts of the marine realm dying off because of a lack of oxygen. Most of what we were talking about in the report you mentioned is with regard to toxic algal blooms.
Why are these blooms considered important enough to draw attention from specialists?
Well, basically, when we talk about harmful algal blooms, we're making a societal decision about this. I mean, these are part of the natural system. These organisms, you asked earlier, what makes them toxic or why are they toxic? They produce compounds that we don't know we don't know why they produce these compounds, but if these compounds get concentrated in the food web, say if you're looking at a good example, would see if you're eating shellfish, like for example, bivalves, mussels, or oysters, these feed on the phytoplankton, and you know there's not enough toxin in a few phytoplankton to be harmful to us. But when you start having an organism that feeds on many millions of these every hour, then that toxin can sometimes be concentrated within the shellfish. And so we get a much higher dose. And the reasons why they produce that, we don't understand, but it's part of the natural system. And as you say, though, there's only a relatively small group of these organisms that are harmful to us. And so those are the ones that we focus on.
Could you give us an example of a classic case of a harmful bloom that happened and its consequences?
Well, there are many cases where it doesn't matter whether you're in Europe, you're in Asia, whether you're in North America and Africa. Everywhere there are numerous cases where shellfish become toxic. And they become toxic because, as I say, of the phytoplankton they're consuming. And the relatively small amounts of toxin in each organism that get concentrated in the organism, they're concentrated in the flesh of the organisms we eat. And a good example of that could say from North America, if you're on the west coast of North America, we have blooms of a group of organisms called Pseudomyces that produce a toxin called bimolic acid. There was massive blooms in 2015, moving all the way back 1989, there was a massive bloom, but these blooms can end up causing closures of fisheries, they end up with ecological impacts, so you will end up having organisms higher up in the food web that either die or are impaired because of the concentration of those toxins moving up into the food web.
Has anyone kept good records of blooms, and if so, are they increasing over the past 40 years or not?
Well, that's really a good question, and one that we don't have as good an answer for you as we would like. The blooms have, in some areas, the toxic blooms have been increasing. On a global scale, there's a fairly recent report out, where they tried to statistically analyze these, the reports, because they are reported. Certainly in all Western countries and most Asian countries, there are agencies that look at measuring the toxicity or measuring the amount of algal toxins in the seafood supply. And so we do have good records of those. There is no question that there's a lot more reports of toxic events over the past 20 years. The difficulty in trying to extract this statistically is that because there's been such an increase in the consumption of seafood, in the production of seafood, the harvesting of seafood, there's a lot more reporting. So what's not clear on a global scale is whether or not the actual abundance of toxic blooms have been increasing over, say, the past two decades, or it's simply that we're getting a lot better at reporting them. However, I can say that in certain regions, there's no question that there has been some increases in the frequency or intensity of these blooms over the past 20 years or so.
Well, I think we should point out it's more than humans and shellfish. We've got reports of dead mammals, a lot of big fish kills. We have dead stingrays on the bottom and other plants. What, could you talk about the other impacts on natural systems?
Yes, certainly. So from the toxic algal bloom perspective, you're absolutely right that as those toxins get concentrated, bioconcentrated up into the food web. And so in other words, the higher up you go in the food web, the greater the toxicity of the organisms that's being consumed, okay? Because the toxins are what we call lipophilic, or they're fat-soluble, and so they are retained by the organism and concentrated in higher and higher levels. So, yes, you get, for example, sea lions off the west coast of North America. During pseudonychia blooms, you'll see they'll go into grand mal seizures because that's one of the effects of the toxin domoic acid is attacks the brain. And that's because they're consuming anchovies or herring in some cases that have been consuming the algae and concentrating the toxins within the flesh. And so there really can be ecosystem-wide impacts as a consequence of these what we call harmful algal blooms. But the initial definition or the initial reason we started talking about harmful algal blooms was because of their effect on humans. And the study of the effect of these organisms in the broader ecosystem has only really been expanding over the past, let's say, decade or so.
Now, in another field, when it comes to hurricanes, we know big storms get faster when seas are warmer, but the scientists I talk to still don't know what actually triggers hurricane formation. Is that true of algae blooms? Do we know why they happen?
We know very well why the algal blooms in general happen. But as you pointed out, there are tens of thousands of species of marine phytoplankton. However, there's only less than 100 of those that produce toxins that are harmful to us. Now, the real question is, what causes those particular species to bloom? And while we can understand why blooms happen, we really can't understand why certain species bloom when they do. It's still an area of very, very active but difficult research.
Has your group looked into human influences in formation and seriousness of harmful blooms aside from global warming?
Yes, so that's a really good question. The biggest way that humans can interact, I'd say directly, in a local ecosystem is by changing the amount of nutrient inputs. And so there has been a lot of study looking at the effect of nutrients such as nitrate and phosphate inputs as a consequence of industrial, human sewage, etc., into the coastal waters and what those impacts are. In virtually all of those cases, you know, the impacts are in creating larger biomass blooms. And so you can generate harmful algal blooms that are high biomass blooms. However, the linkages between nutrient inputs and toxic bloom occurrence, in other words, does this stimulate the toxic species to bloom? There really, so far, is no good evidence that that's what's happening. So we know that we can have an influence on the system, but we don't yet understand, or we don't yet have evidence that our impact, direct impact on the system, is triggering specifically the toxic algal blooms.
So the big question everyone wants to know, will global warming lead to more or worse harmful algae blooms in the future?
Yeah, that's the question that's attracted a lot of, a huge amount of interest in my field. Let me put it this way. We understand why certain types of phytoplankton bloom at different times. Many of the toxic species that bloom are of a phytoplankton division called dinoflagellates, or basically the fire plants, because they, at night, for example, when there's high biomass of dinoflagellates around, you will see a bioluminescence of the water. Now, most of the toxic blooms are really derived by dinoflagellate blooms, okay? Toxic dinoflagellate blooms, of which, as I say, there's probably less than 50 species out of the thousands of dinoflagellates that occur in the marine environment. Now, basically, what we find is that those species, when they bloom, they end up, they will end up blooming at either at low concentrations. In other words, a bloom isn't necessarily really high abundance of phytoplankton, I'll give you an example, say off the coast of Maine, for example, the blooms, the toxic blooms there are dinoflagellates. The shellfish become toxic when the cells reach something on the order of 100 cells per liter, which is tiny. It's very hard to find them, but the oysters will be filtering enough seawater that they collect enough of that toxin. When we look at, say, the coast of Maine, what we see is the temperature of the ocean surface has been rising. Now, when temperature rises, it becomes basically more like summertime. And when we tend to find these blooms of, say, these dinoflagellates, they occur primarily in the summer. So they are well adapted to those summer-type conditions where the nutrient concentrations tend to be lower because phytoplankton earlier in the year have used them up. And so what we would project is that you're going to end up having more dinoflagellate blooms as we move into the future because the surface waters are warming, so the nutrient levels will end up being lower. And as a consequence, it's those type of species that do well. Now, while we could intuitively project and expect that there'll be a lot more dinoflagellate blooms, we suspect that that's also going to include the toxic species. So the expectation is that we will end up having more toxic algal blooms from the dinoflagellate groups. It may be that we have less toxic blooms from other groups that aren't as well adapted to those warming conditions.
Reading through the science, I began to wonder, are harmful algal blooms like weeds? I mean, weeds pop up when biosystems have been disturbed, say, by a fire. In this case, it's not so much that climate change causes a harmful outbreak, but damage to competitive communities leaves the field more open to them. What do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting analogy. I don't like using the word weeds for them because really they are part of a natural part of the system. And like when we say harmful, weeds has sort of a subjective view on it. But nevertheless, your point is a good one, is that as the conditions change, basically, you're making, okay, if we can think of it this way, you could take an analogy of a group of, say, 100 people. Well, they all have different food tastes. They like different types of food more than other types of food. They'll eat all of the food, but they do better when, or they enjoy more when they eat certain types of food. Well, as your system changes, your ecosystem changes, in essence, you're changing the situation such that some species are going to end up being able to do better than other species. Not that the other species can't grow, it's just that the ones that do the best will grow the fastest, and therefore they'll tend to end up dominating the communities. At least that's what we call a bottom-up perspective. In other words, what might allow certain species to grow better than others.
So a big bloom shows up near the coast and it's reported in the local news. What comes after? Do the former plankton and bacteria and larger species return and recover? Or does a new complex of living things develop?
No, basically what happens is that in virtually all cases, what you'll see is that the system resets itself again. You can think of this in a seasonal basis, okay? If you're dealing with, say, temperate waters or mid-latitude regions. You go into the wintertime, and that basically resets everything so that the new spring comes up and you end up with slightly different sets of conditions, and so you never tend to get exactly the same species dominating each year. There's always some mixtures. So it's not like we've transformed the system entirely if climate change is going to have this impact. It's more that we're making it more likely that certain species will end up becoming present in higher numbers more frequently than in the past, but not necessarily every year.
In another study published in The Lancet in 2023 by Chris C. Lim, they looked into harmful algal bloom aerosols in human health. Can bits of the toxic bloom float inland and into our lungs?
Yeah, that's another great question. There are some species of dinoflagellates that you can think of, basically the cell is like a grape, okay? It has an outer surface, okay, a membrane on the outer surface. Now, in some cases, that membrane is reinforced with some we call it armor, but basically it's like thin wood, if you will, lignin-based, cellulose-based plates that help protect the organism. So if they've got the armor, they're tougher. The grape won't break, okay? But if they don't have armor, then if you get into high turbulence environments, you can actually break the cell up, okay? So this is what happens with some cells in say, surf environments, where you have the waves come in, they hit the surf, it's high turbulence, the cells can be broken up. The material that's in the cell that contains the toxin then can become aerosolized, and so it'll transport with the water droplets along the shore, and they can be inhaled, and they will have an impact on people. So, for example, in Florida, one location where they will put out warnings that because the harmful algal bloom is coming on shore, and it's a particular type of species that they know is going to break up on in the shore environment, they'll forecast for people perhaps to stay away from the beach areas.
Well, these events can bring widespread damage. I'm thinking of drinking water, ocean species killed, maybe aerosol harms, as we've talked about, tourism lost, fisheries income lost, and more. But so far, if we can't predict how toxic blooms will change with climate, isn't this a dangerous thing not to know as warming speeds up?
Well, absolutely. What you'll find is that there have been very few studies looking at the overall economic impact from blooms, but they basically move through society. So you have the fisheries. So who is doing the harvesting of the fisheries? Well, if you have to shut the fisheries down because of the toxic level in whatever that fishery is, whether it be bivalves or other, then those producers or those fishermen are obviously hit hard. But then it comes to the suppliers of the materials that they need for fishing, and they are hit hard. You have the tourism side where they close beaches, and so now suddenly people don't show up. And so the cascading economic impacts can be huge. Forecasting these events is really, if you want, that would be the gold standard that we all strive towards. But because we don't understand at this stage what triggers the toxic species from appearing in sufficient quantities to become harmful, we can't forecast it. We can make general forecasts. So I'll go back to the state of Maine, for example. We know we can forecast every year you're going to have closures due to the presence of toxins. We can't forecast where those closures will be, what parts of the coast of Maine. We can't forecast when it will be, down to the point of, say, weeks or something like that. But we can say that every summer you're going to end up having closures. And unfortunately, that's about as good as we can do for the most part.
Well, one of the purposes of these workshops and your summary papers is to answer that key question. What kind of research could provide the best answers in the shortest period of time? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, you know, the thing is we've been studying harmful algal blooms for decades, and we've been looking at them from the point of view of the cell, primarily. What is it about the cell? Why do they produce the toxins? What are they using the toxins for? We grow them in culture, and we study how they grow and how the toxin level may change as they grow. We study, to some extent, what the occurrence of them in the coastal environment. In most cases, we're using those same records that I mentioned that are being kept by agencies for food safety. But what we haven't been doing as much, we are now, over the past, say, certainly 5 years, we're starting to look a lot more intensely at what factors of changing climate might influence the relative competitive ability of these phytoplankton. And the problem is that if you want to, say, look at temperature, all these species, like your houseplants, they all have an optimal temperature, but they have quite a temperature range over which they can grow. And the optimal temperature range for many species is very similar, the toxic versus the non-toxic. So temperature alone is not going to drive into a toxic bloom. The same thing with nutrient levels. There isn't that much difference. So it's probably down more in some of these finer aspects. And this is where the climate change impact is likely to occur. So we are starting now to try and get a better idea about how some of these other factors may help, if you want, bolster a certain, say, toxic species from becoming more successful than the non-toxic compatriots in the same water.
From Maine, we've been speaking with harmful algal bloom expert Dr. Mark Wells. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you for spending time with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with everyone.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.
All right, bravo. One more car destroyed.